listening to the English language news of Kan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
Okay. It's 8 p.m. in Israel, Friday, April 5th, 2024. Good evening and Shabbat Shalom. This is Aryeh O'Sullivan with the news. The country is on high alert for a possible retaliation by Iran and its proxies for the alleged Israeli strike in Damascus this week that killed top Iranian Revolutionary Guard officers. The IDF has canceled leave for some IDF soldiers, and Israel is taking precautionary steps for its embassies abroad. In Lebanon, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah says that there will be, without a doubt, an Iranian response to the assassination of the senior officials in Damascus. In a speech that was broadcast remotely, Nasrallah said that he would not specify where, when, and what the nature of the response would be. But, according to him, Iran would not tolerate an attack on their consulate and their sovereignty. According to him, the region is now reaching a new stage, and everyone should prepare for it and for all the possibilities. Regarding the damage suffered by his organization, Nasrallah said that the fighters are prepared in spite of everything, and that if he wants to launch 100 missiles to the Golan Heights, he can do so. Whether there will be casualties or not, this is war, said Nasrallah. Meanwhile, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant says that the preparedness and vigilance are not synonyms for panic and fear. The enemy was hit hard in all places and is therefore looking for ways to respond. We are ready with a multi-layered defense, Gallant said, during a visit to the Air Force Base Tel Nof. We attack wherever the state of Israel decides against an enemy. It can be in Damascus and it can be in Beirut. Our attack is very strong, very energetic, very accurate, and hits the enemy hard, in Gallant's words. In the north, an IDF soldier was lightly wounded by an anti-tank missile fired at the Matula area. His family was informed, and he was evacuated to a hospital for treatment. The IDF attacked the source of the fire in the southern Lebanon with artillery fire. Overnight, seven launches were identified at Moshav Dishon in the Upper Galilee. There were no casualties and no damage reported. The shooting that caused the death of the seven workers of the aid organization WCK in the Gaza Strip this week was carried out contrary to the instructions and opening fire procedures and without the necessary approvals. This according to an IDF investigation into the incident. IDF Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Herzi Alevi dismissed two officers in the Nahal Brigade, the relief officer at the rank of Major, and the Brigade Chief of Staff with the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. Alevi also reprimanded three senior officers for their command responsibilities: the head of the Southern Command, Major General Yaron Finkelman, the commander of the 162nd Division, Brigadier General Itzik Cohen, and the commander of the Nahal Brigade, Colonel Yair Zuckerman. The investigation revealed that officials in the Nahal Brigade fired from a drone at the aid workers after it mistakenly identified them as armed terrorists. It did not clearly identify the organization's logo on the roof of the vehicle. The investigation was overseen by the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency's investigation mechanism, Reserve Major General Yoav Har-Evan. He presented it to the Prime Minister, the Minister of Defense, the ambassadors of the countries whose citizens were killed in the incident, and the founder of the World Central Kitchen, Chef Jose Andres. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken responded to the IDF's investigation, saying that it is important that Israel bear responsibility and that measures be taken against those responsible. Blinken also said that in the coming days in Washington, the report's conclusions will be discussed with Israeli officials and humanitarian organizations. According to Blinken, any operation that Israel conducts against Hamas should be prioritizing the safety of the citizens of Gaza. We are waiting to see not only the steps that will be taken to that end, but also the results, Blinken said.
IDF activity in the Gaza Strip in the past day. Air Force fighter jets attacked more than 30 terrorist targets. In addition, artillery struck a launch site from which rockets were fired last night at Ashkelon and the Gaza periphery communities. In Khan Yunus, a booby trap building was destroyed by tank fire from the armored 7th Brigade combat team. Meanwhile, Israel is stepping up the pace of humanitarian aid in the Gaza Strip. The Kerem Shalom and the Erez crossings and the port of Ashdod are expected to be open today, Shabbat, according to a political security cabinet decision last night. Foreign Minister Yisrael Katz objected to the transferring of aid through the Ashdod port on the grounds that this contradicts the approach that the connection between Israel and the Gaza Strip should be severed. However, the foreign minister made it clear that he supports increasing aid to the Gaza Strip for political reasons. Before the cabinet convened, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke with U.S. President Joe Biden. Biden demanded that Netanyahu increase the supply of humanitarian aid to the residents of the Gaza Strip. In other news, in the fight against terrorism in Judea and Samaria, in Tulkarm, a terrorist was killed this morning during the arrest of three wanted Palestinians suspected of involvement in terrorism. Undercover border police officers arrested three wanted terrorists, sparking a riot during which a terrorist threw a bomb at the undercover officers. That terrorist was shot dead. There were no injuries to Israeli forces. Muslim prayers on the Jerusalem Temple Mount did not go without violence on this last Friday of the month of Ramadan. At the end of dawn prayers, inciting calls were made, sparking rioting by some worshippers. A police drone sprayed tear gas on the mob, and after the crowd dispersed, police arrested eight people on suspicion of incitement to terrorism or support for terrorists. Four of the detainees were residents of East Jerusalem, and four from the Galilee. Well, that's the news for tonight. Now to our pre-recorded culture program.
You're listening to the English language news of Khan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
Good evening and welcome to our Friday night program with a look at culture and lifestyle stories we covered this week. I'm Ariel O'Sullivan. Let's get started. This week, we look into a new study on trust between Israeli Jews and Arabs after October 7th. And we hear about a new piece of fiction, Cloning Hitler. Then we hear about English theater in Israel, science awards, and new technologies. Trust between Israeli Arabs and Jews was severely damaged in the aftermath of the October 7th attacks, with a sharp rise in negative attitudes each side holds against the other. A study by the Hebrew University of Jerusalem Accord Center found that in January, these heightened negative attitudes remain at about the same levels. Yet, concerns of an explosion into violence have not been realized. Our reporter Nomi Segal heard more from Ron Gerlitz, Executive Director of ACORD, Social Psychology for Social Change.
So I think the main findings of this research, which indeed it is a research that we conducted in a few points of time before October 7th and twice after, one in the end of October and one in recent January, is that in October we saw, and it's not a surprise, a significant increase of negative emotion and attitudes between Jews and Arabs, especially among Jews towards Arabs in Israel. The level that we saw in October and is still with us in general is extremely high and very, I would say, explosive. In the January research, we would hope, I would say, to see a decrease in this negative emotion, but unfortunately, we didn't see a decrease. We see a stable situation between October and January.
So what does that mean, that it stabilized?
It means that the current state of relation is still in a dangerous situation, is still very explosive. Those high level, I can just maybe give you one number, 40% of the Jews have high level of hate towards Arabs in Israel. Those are very high numbers, and those are the kind of things that can cause explosive and violence between the groups in Israel.
And what about the attitudes within the Arab population towards the Jews? What were those concerns?
Among the Arabs, we didn't find a significant increase in our research during October and January. There can be few explanations for that. And I can say that maybe for the first time, we think that maybe Arabs were really afraid to say really what they think in this research, because Arab citizens in Israel feel a real fear from from Jews in Israel and from the security services. So we are not sure that people were honest in their answers, and we have like a question mark on that like field of the research.
So when you're looking at these figures about this heightened state of mutual fear of the other, that's sort of complicated situation to maintain for a sustained period, especially if one is concerned about some kind of explosion.
Yes, indeed, and we should remember that many of us, right after October 7, were afraid and projected that there will be violence between Jews and Arabs in Israel, and I think we should not take it. We should not take it for granted the fact that there wasn't violence, because like everything was there, such high level of negative emotions. Hundreds of thousands of Jews and Arabs meet on a daily basis in Israel without any wall between them. So much weapons on both sides. We should also remember there are people that work for and desire escalation between Jews and Arabs in Israel. Unfortunately, one of them is the Minister of Internal Security. We had like all the reason in the world, or we had like at least many reasons that we would have seen violence between Jews and Arabs in Israel. Fortunately, and I think there are some reasons that we didn't see a violence between Jews and Arabs, at least so far.
What, in your assessment, would be some of those reasons?
I think there can be two explanations. One explanation would say people are simply afraid. Jews are afraid to open like another front in addition to the Gazan one and maybe one in the north. And Arabs are just terrified from the Jews and from security services. We should remember that Arabs were arrested just to put things on their Facebook. So this could be one explanation. But I think there is another explanation which I believe is a stronger explanation. And it is that the processes that we saw in the Israeli society in the recent 10, 15 years of the beginning of the integration of the Arab citizens into the Israeli society and economy and academy resulted in the fact that, unlike in the past, so many Jews and Arabs meet really on a daily basis. Really on a daily basis. We speak like about hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Jews and Arabs that meet in the employment market and in the health system, in the academy. And we found in our research that the fact that people have like a positive encounter with people from the other group is going together with a lower negative emotion and lower negative intention or intention to negative behavior. So it might be that the fact that we see a beginning of infrastructure in shared society in Israel served like an immune factor for eruption of Jews, of violence between Jews and Arabs. This can be one factor. And another factor that since October, I would say 10, 11, we saw significant efforts by many leaders on both sides, Jewish and Arabs, side that worked very hard to avoid that violence. And I'm sure that this work and those efforts on the ground were another factor that avoided the escalation into violence.
So going forward, what might you expect to see, and do proactive steps need to be taken?
So the second question is easier. For sure, proactive steps must be taken. We are in a very high and explosive level of negative attitudes of Jews and Arabs towards each other. If we do, and by the way, it's kind of natural after what happened in October 7th and because of the war. If we do nothing about it, okay, this is the thing that can cause violence between the groups. And those things don't disappear by themselves. The Israeli system, government, education system should address the challenge of those negative perceptions. I would say, with the current government, it is extremely difficult. But all leaders in the Israeli society must address this challenge from the very simple reason. If Jews and Arabs don't, citizens in Israel, don't succeed to have, I would say, even a normal relationship, the Israeli society and economy cannot function. We have like a big, very big interest, you know, hospitals, transportation system, so many infrastructure in Israel simply cannot function if Jews and Arabs cannot work together. That's what we have a very strong interest. Going forward, I hope that we are not going into violence. So far, there is a success of the both groups, I would say. We are in extremely bad days of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but inside Israel, Jews and Arabs slash Palestinian, almost 6 months succeeded to avoid violence between the groups. I think this is a success. We should work very hard to keep in this direction.
Do you think that is affected in part by a sense of shared fate or driven by a sense of fear?
I think it's more in the direction of shared faith. And I would say even more in the direction of, you know, we are here together and we need to find ways to live together. And also because I would say how much you can hate the doctor that you take your kids when they have like something and you go to hospital, or the person that gives you services in some places. I mean, those are people that you know, that you see on a daily basis. I think that the very bad situation of dehumanization that exists between Israel and Palestinian in the general Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for sure between Israelis and Palestinians in Gaza during these days of the war, doesn't exist between Jews and Arabs in Israel. This dehumanization doesn't exist, and I think that it is more the beginning of the shared society between Jews and Arabs plays a stronger factor in the fact that we didn't see violence so far.
Ron Gerlitz, Executive Director of ACORD. In a covert laboratory under the streets of Tel Aviv, Akiva Cohen, an Israeli scientist, clones Hitler from old samples of his DNA. Akiva wants to change the world for the good, but he is betrayed by those who want to use this new Hitler for unimaginable terror. This is the premise for Alex Sinclair's new debut novel, Perfect Enemy, a thriller that takes a deep dive into Israeli society and raises probing questions about trauma and revenge, the desire for peace, religious extremism, and the schisms of the Middle East. Sinclair is a British-Israeli educator and lecturer who has written and spoken widely on Jewish education, Israel diaspora relations, and Israeli politics. He spoke to our reporter Naomi Segal about the book, its resonance in the post-October 7th reality, and his foray into fiction.
It's a thriller, for sure. It's got a bit of politics in it, a bit of romance, a bit of kind of, not exactly sci-fi, but kind of like science-y kind of elements to it. And it's really a thriller set in Israeli society, about Israeli society. The premise of the book is that you have an Israeli scientist called Akiva Cohen, who has somehow managed to clone Hitler from old samples of Hitler's DNA. The book is really follows in what happens. Akiva's part of this team, and there are other people in the team. As you can imagine, things don't go straightforwardly. There are all kinds of other characters as well. And really, the book's really becomes the science-y part, the kind of cloning part, kind of fades into the background a little bit, and the book becomes a thriller, which, like I said, touches on aspects of Israeli politics and Israeli society. It's kind of asking the question, really, how do we respond to trauma? What do you do? You know, we live as people who live in the shadow of the Holocaust. After October the 7th, we live in the shadow of all kinds of other, you know, traumatic events that we've been going through the past few months. How do you respond to that trauma? You know, what do you how do we as a people kind of respond to those kinds of those parts of our psyche? And the book kind of explores that in a pretty exciting, suspenseful way, with some lots of twists and turns.
Now, you wrote this book before October 7th. Actually, you started writing it a few years ago. It is, in some ways, a deep dive into Israeli society and ideology and politics. Before October 7th and after October 7th, do some of the messages already in the book, do they resonate differently for you?
I think on a certain level, the answer has to be yes. You know, I think everything resonates differently for me. I'm sure for you as well, for all Israelis. You know, I mean, I joke that the way I tie my shoelaces now is different from the way I did on October the 6th. It's not a joke. It's kind of sort of the devastating thing to say, but kind of we go around, everything in life is different. So on the one hand, it is different. And on the other hand, some of the things, most of the stuff that the book is talking about is stuff that's even more relevant today. I mean, I'll give an example. One of the kind of themes that the book raises and grapples with is the rise of the extremist right wing in Israeli society. You know, there's one of the characters in it is a kind of Bezalel Smotrich, Itamar Ben Gvir kind of character, or at least somebody who comes from that kind of world. You know, and pre-October the 7th, I at least, you know, found those kinds of, you know, I find that kind of worldview, that kind of political and religious worldview, really troubling and problematic and deeply concerning for me, at least, and for the kind of Israel and the kind of Jewish people that I want to see. And the book kind of really kind of plays with that. And you know, I think post October the 7th, those kinds of issues got quietened for a little bit as we all got really, you know, consumed by the initial stages of the war and the hostages, etc. But now I think we're seeing those issues bubble to the surface again in Israel. And I think, look, you know, right now Israel faces an external struggle with Hamas. You know, we face an external struggle with people who literally want to kill us, and we have to win that struggle. But we also face an internal struggle, which is, I would call it, a struggle for the soul of the Jewish people. And for the sort of what we want Jewishness and Judaism and Jewishness in Israel to look like. And, you know, that's one that the book really kind of grapples with. It kind of, you know, it's not exactly right versus left, but it really kind of puts that kind of worldview in front of the reader's face and says, okay, you know, what are you going to do about this? What do you think about this? So that's one of the issues that the book raises.
Now, you've dealt with these issues and ideas in your professional life as a Jewish educator, a lecturer, someone who's very involved in Israel diaspora relations. You've written about this from a nonfiction perspective. Mm-hmm. What made you decide to take the plunge into fiction, and when did that begin?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I taught at the Jewish Theological Seminary for many, many years and taught classes on Israel education. And like you said, I wrote a book, and you know, a kind of academic education book, and many articles about how we teach Israel and how we talk about Israel. I guess at some point I felt that I'd said everything I had to say from a nonfiction perspective. You know, I felt like I was writing stuff that was just rewritten versions of things that I'd said previously, and I kind of felt that, you know, I'd said everything I wanted to say, and a lot of the stuff I was reading were, you know, I think even today, you know, still feels, I read an article or an op-ed in the press, and it's like, oh, that's just another version of what that person wrote a year ago or 2 years ago. So I wanted to try something else. I've always had this sort of one of my favorite Hebrew phrases is that, you know, I have a juk barosh, literally a cockroach in my head, which is a great phrase. And I always had this cockroach in my head that I might try to write something, some fiction. And then I had this crazy idea, which was the kind of kernel for the book, and then began writing. And then the rest is history. There's a cute little story. Actually, this is actually the second piece of fiction I ever wrote. The first piece of fiction I ever wrote, was published when I was 10 years old, and I won a competition in London where I grew up, that was run by Capital Radio, which was London and still is London's main kind of music radio station. It was a competition to write a fairy tale for Princess Diana. She was pregnant at that stage with her first baby, with Prince William, who became then Prince William. And I was one of six winners out of I don't know how many thousand entries. And it was presented to Princess Diana for her to read as a bedtime story to Prince William. So I don't know if she ever did read my story as a bedtime story to Prince William. But that was the first story that I ever wrote for publication. This is the second.
So, from fairy tales to thrillers, you certainly can't be boxed into a certain kind of genre.
That's true. And it's a thriller, but it's also got some kind of funny scenes in it as well, and some good characters. It's a plot driven sort of suspense novel, but it's got some great characters in it. There's another couple of characters in a young female Israeli politician who's in a relationship with a Palestinian businessman from East Jerusalem. And her name is Hadass, his name is Omar. And Hadass and Omar, they become really kind of central protagonists in the book as well. There's a kind of, the book has these kind of two parallel storylines. One is with Akiva, the scientist, and his funder, a guy by the name of Yoav, and Yoav is the kind of Bezalel Smotrich kind of character, and that runs in parallel to the Hadass Omar storyline. And then at some point the storylines weave together. Obviously I can't say how, because that would be spoilers, but Hadass and Omar are a major protagonist in the book as well.
So would you say you're trying to convey a message through this book and this very exciting plot, or raise questions for the readers about Israel through these various types?
I think more raise questions. Look, I really wanted the book to do two things. I wanted it to be a fun, exciting read, and for people to, even people who don't know Israel, I mean, the book's not written for Jewish people per se, it's written for a general audience. And I think that even people who don't know Israel at all will enjoy it as a just a kind of fun, exciting thriller. And I wanted it to raise questions. I don't think it has a message. I think in a way it has the opposite of a message. It raises questions without kind of coming down. I mean, none of the characters escape, with kind of unblemished moral records. They all get into situations which kind of force them into, to make problematic decisions of one sort or another. So nobody comes out with a clean bill of health, as it were. It raises questions about the right. It raises questions about the left. It raises questions about the Palestinians as well, and about their kind of struggle between moderates and extremists. So I hope it kind of leaves the reader having had a great time reading it, and also with a whole bunch of kind of questions to think about Israel and Israeli society and the conflict with the Palestinians and so on.
And you're headed on a book tour soon.
I'm heading on a book tour. I'm going to be in the States in April, in a week and a half, in the beginning part of April. And I'll be at about five different places talking about the book, and talking also a little bit about using the book as a springboard to talk a little bit about Israeli society. So the website is alexjsinclair.com/perfectenemy. So if you go there to alexjsinclair.com/perfectenemy, then you see a list of the places that I'm going to be speaking.
Alex Sinclair, author of Perfect Enemy. And now here's David Broza and his song, Mutar Lumar, You're Allowed to Say.
Yes, Leon. Now.
English theatre in Israel, Hadar Garon, a writer, director and actress, is starring in a monodrama play in English this spring called Whistle, My Mother Was Mengele's Secretary, which tells the story of a second-generation Holocaust survivor. Garon spoke to me about the production as well as her miniseries Harem, based on the true story of a cult in Tel Aviv led by a guru who had over 20 wives and 80 children, which was just sold to Netflix.
The play itself isn't new. It's been since 2019, but in English and here in Israel, it's going to be on the 1st of May, just before Yom HaShoah. Mm-hmm. It's a play. It's a monodrama that's been going around, been translated to 9 languages. I wrote it together with a book author, Yaakov Buchan. Yaakov Buchan was born in Austria in a camp just after the war, after his parents had been freed, but they weren't yet, they didn't have a home, they didn't have a family, they didn't have anything. His mother had survived because she was chosen to be Mengele's secretary and translator.
Goodness.
So for 4 years she was, that's what she did. She didn't want to get pregnant when she was in the camp. There was a British doctor there that kind of postponed. She asked for an abortion. He postponed it until it was too late to have an abortion. That's the story he grew up on.
Wow.
Until it was too late to give up on you. So he grew up, as he calls it, a transparent child. That's what he says, that the second generation, many of them are transparent children or like the sponge to the pain of their parents, born into a world like with no right of their own or needs of their own. They always need to put their parents before them. And he wanted to do this play about second generation, about the experience of second generation. So that's why he came to me. And I met him for like a year every week, hearing more and more and also reading his books, because some of the pieces are taken from his books.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, we came to the conclusion that it's, you know, it's the invisible wounds. It's the invisible wounds of the people who have who've been born in the shadows of the Holocaust, the second generation. Sometimes it's third generation. In fact, when we were doing rehearsals, Hanna Vazana is the director of this piece. When we were doing rehearsals for Whistle, I was actually writing a play for the Czech Republic called Jewish Enough for Hitler. And I was interviewing second and third generation there. Some of them didn't even know that they were Jewish until they were adults.
Wow.
And it seems, though, that the experience goes through generations, even if you don't know the story, even if you haven't heard the stories. It goes through, Yaakov Buchan calls it like a second blood system.
Wow.
Second blood system. Because many psychologists and psychoanalysts speak about the way that, you know, trauma goes. It's intergenerational.
The second generation. Let me ask you a question about the play. You said it's a monodrama. Does this mean like it's a one-man show?
In this case, a one-woman show, yes.
One-woman show, okay.
It's a one-woman show. It's about a woman who was born to two Holocaust survivors. Her mother was Mengele's secretary. And she kind of goes through life, but only in midlife, like age 45, she suddenly realizes that she's never really been loved, and she's never really loved as she dreams of loving. She did get married. She got married to a professor who was like 20 years her senior. And so it all begins because a stranger came into her life. He's a gardener, but, you know, one day he roamed into her garden, picked a peach off the tree. And she says, who are you? Who gave you permission to come in here and steal my fruit? And she begins to fall in love with this guy who comes in once a week. She wants for the first time in her life to really love as she dreams she can, but for this she needs to kind of face her ghosts, face her mother, face her, you know, just to get rid of all the things that are blocking her from this.
Well, don't give us any spoiler or anything, but how long is the play?
An hour.
Mm-hmm.
An hour. It's won many international prizes, by the way, and it's... it's in a nutshell. It's you know, from the moment she asks her husband if he's okay with it, if she has someone else, until she actually manages to leave the door. But you go, when we go through that, I do all the parts, as in monodramas, but, you know, her and her mother are the most present.
Fascinating. And you decided to put this in English because why?
Because I do it in English abroad, and many people in Israel, there are many English speakers who often ask me, but wait, but we saw some pieces in English, and why don't you do it in English here in Israel? So I've decided to perform at the Camry Theatre, and so there will be on the 1st of May, just a few days before Yom HaShoah, there will be an English play and a Hebrew play.
Excellent.
At 7 p.m., the English one.
I want to go on to something else now. Tell me a little bit about the Harem and Netflix.
Yeah, that's from yesterday, or the 1st of April, although it wasn't a joke. Harem is a TV series that I am one of the creators and the writers. I actually began this together with my good friend Anat Barzilai. Later on, like a year before, it took us like 5 years of studying the cults. Like 5 years into the process, we were joined with another creator who was also one of the two directors.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, this was fascinating. A woman who had been for 12 years in the cult of Goel Ratzon, she's the one that came to us and wanted us to make a play out of this. And as we went deeper and deeper into the material, we realized this is much bigger than a play, but it's, you know, maybe a film. And then, no, it's a TV series. You know, as we were going through it, it was just never-ending, the stories.
This is about the Goel Ratzon cult?
Yes.
Okay. Sentences for our listeners. What is this about?
Goel Ratzon lived in Tel Aviv with over 20 wives and over 80 children. We know of 89 children, but there probably are more. And the question that we went with is, how come women and girls from good homes, intelligent, who have, you know, their own free will, how of their own free will did they choose to go into a place where someone took all their freedom away from them?
Wow.
How could this be? And, you know, as it is with many cults, Goel Ratzon, he knew, first of all, how to find their cracks, find their traumas. He was very good at that. And then he would kind of sell them their freedom for the price of their freedom. But they didn't realize that was the price until it was too late. So it's like you hear, maybe I come from a very religious family. So we hear sometimes cults and extreme religion are very much alike, because, you know, they say, you know, what's freedom? What's freedom? Is freedom, you know, doing what you want, buying what you want, traveling where you want? Or is freedom of the mind? Let's free you of money and free you of you know, of meaningless, boring lives. We'll free you, really. We'll bring you to the core of your existence, to the real reason that you are in this world. Will free you of toxic relationships. So it's kind of, that's the catch 22 in all cults, is how Goel Ratzon managed to convince women. Our cult leader is called Shabtai.
Okay.
Yes, because of Shabtai Tzvi.
Hadar, your series was sold to Netflix?
Yes.
So what does that mean? It's going to be made
in 2018 and was sold to Netflix. I found out only when I saw the first advertisement on the on the internet.
Well, so what does that mean? Like, for they're going to translate it and make it into a different venue or what?
No. It's going to be on Netflix. You can see it now on Netflix with English subtitles.
Okay.
I also act in the series. I'm the social worker, who is also secretly one of his women.
Wow.
Kind of psycho killer character. Small character, but, you know, I used my British facade for this character.
So if someone wants to see this, they have to go to Netflix and it's going to have English subtitles.
Yes, it's on Netflix since yesterday and it has English subtitles. I will say that at these times, when we're seeing so much horror of people who were captivated, not of their own free will, and are not with some cult leader, but are in the hands of monsters and terrorists, I must say, as I do in every interview I have for anywhere, we need to do the utmost we can to get the women and men out of Gaza.
Absolutely. Hadar Galron, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Hadar Galron. Here's a beautiful song with an eerie story, sung in Yiddish by Chava Alberstein. It's called Margarita Kalach, Little Daisy, about a chance encounter in the woods between a golden-haired girl and a black-haired man.
Gegangen ist Chavale, still und verhudend, zerlosen die goldblonde Zepp. Das Herzland bläust und gemurmelt verhudend, das Liedele tra-la-la-la. Da kommt ihr entgegen, a Bocher, a Schwarzer, mit Locken, mit Schwarze, flammt mir die Augen und entfährt ihr lustig und entfährt ihr tra-la-la-la. Was suchst du, Mädel? Was hast du verloren? Was willst du gefunden in groß? Ich such Margaritkes, verreutelt sich Habe, verreutelt sich tra-la-la-la. Du suchst noch, und ich hab schon einen Tag gefunden, die schönste Margaritke in der Wald. A Margaritke mit Zepp und mit Augen Saphiren, mit Eigelach tra-la-la-la. Nein, ich hab schon einen Margaritkes. Ich hab sich vergessen, ich such da nicht weit, is a Qual. Der Qual is geschlossen und mir bleibst du durstig beim Quellchele tra-la-la-la. Ich will gar nicht trinken. Ich such mir a Schotten. Die Sonne backt da rein so heiß. Meine Haare sind in schwarzer und kieler wie Schotten in der Wäldele tra-la-la-la. Ah, lass mich, mein Tor nicht. Die Mama sagt mein Tor nicht. Mein Mama ist alt und ist beis. Wo Mama, was Mama? Da sind nur Bäume, nur Bäume lacht tra-la-la-la. Man sieht, keiner seht nicht, man hört, keiner hört nicht. Das Wädel ist blind und gedicht. Umarme mich, Süße, siehst, ich bin ruhig, ich kusch dich nur, tra la la la. Du liebst mich, ich lieb dich, du schämst dich, ich schäm mich. Lieb mich und schäm sich und schweig und seh, wie es mischen sich pech schwarze Kreuzen mit goldene Tralalala. Die Sonne ist vergangen, der Bocher verschwinden. Und Chavale sitzt noch in der Wald. Sie guckt in der Weitens und murmelt verhohlend das Liedele tralalala. Sie guckt in der Weitens und murmelt verhohlend das Liedele.
In science, the Blavatnik Award for Young Scientists were announced this week. The prestigious award went to three scientists from the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel in recognition of their groundbreaking work in various fields. Each recipient will also receive a $100,000 prize. We spoke with one of the recipients, Dr. Moran Shalev Ben-Ami, a senior scientist at the Weizmann Institute of Science, who's working on sensing and signaling mechanisms in the brain that may help treat appetite disorders.
Our lab works on the human brain. I mean, we are at the Department of Chemistry, but we're working a lot on biology. So we're recognized at determining the three-dimensional structures of several key proteins that compose the brain.
What did you discover?
So we were working on several different aspects of the human brain, but I think that the one that is of most interest to the audience is the key protein that is in charge on the hunger mechanism. Basically, it's the molecular switch that decides whether we are hungry or not.
Wow. So what do you hope to do with that type of knowledge?
So what we hope to do is, of course, to understand how this protein works. And more importantly, we want to understand what happens when this protein doesn't work anymore because you have a mutation that would ultimately caused in illness, and we would like to learn how to fix it when it doesn't work properly.
Interesting. The Blavatnik Award is given to young scientists in Israel. How does getting an award like yourself help you?
Well, it gives you a boost of energy, first, to be recognized, but more importantly, it gives you now opportunities to try new things. Really gives you the energy to try and do some new stuff that are a bit dangerous in a very early career stage.
You're a young Israeli scientist, and Israel, you're part of this group of Israel, is known to be a powerhouse, a greenhouse for young scientists with breakthroughs in technology. Why do you think Israel is producing people like you?
I'm not sure Israel is producing people like me.
I mean, they talk about the startup nation.
That's true, but I think that Israel teaches us to be very independent and very out-of-the-box thinkers from a very young age. I think we feel it at our school systems. Of course, when we serve the military, so you leave the house very early, you have to be very independent, and I think it gives us some other characteristics.
Really? I mean, understand that hierarchy also isn't like it is in Israel, like elsewhere. I mean, you can approach anybody you want here, right?
That's true. This is part of the Israeli chutzpah, right?
Do you find that helps you in your scientific research?
I mean, yeah, it helps to dare, you know, to dare to approach people, even if they're really big and famous, and you can just write an email or make a phone call and connect. And these connections are very important. So in a way, yeah, it does.
Well, congratulations on receiving the award.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Moran Shalev Ben-Ami. Turning to tech, Imagine Dairy, an Israeli food tech company specializing in the production of animal-free dairy proteins, has achieved a significant milestone by receiving a no-questions letter from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. This formal recognition enables the Imagine Dairy to introduce its products into the American market. Imagine Dairy's animal-free dairy proteins replicate the taste, texture, functionality, and nutritional value of traditional cow's dairy proteins, but are cholesterol-free, lactose-free, and hormone-free. The fermentation process for producing the proteins also aims to have lower environmental impacts than those associated with traditional dairy production. The Haifa-based company was founded in 2020 with the support of the Strauss Group and its incubator, the Kitchen Food Tech Hub. Imagine Dairy co-founder and CEO Eyal Afragan spoke to our reporter Naomi Segal.
So Imagine Dairy is a company that was established in order to create real dairy without the cows through the use of precision fermentation. Means that we teach microorganisms, in our case mushroom, kind of mushroom. We teach them how to produce milk proteins that are identical to the proteins in cow's milk. You know that in milk you have around 3.4% proteins, which is basically all the magic in milk. And with this protein, you can they are basically the infrastructure for any dairy product you find in the supermarket. So Imagine Dairy developing this kind of proteins in mushrooms and are able to develop the whole range of dairy products that everybody can find on the shelves in the supermarkets.
Now, it's interesting you're referring to it as dairy products, not dairy substitutes or non-dairy dairy products. There's something conceptual here, perhaps. Is it in the way that people perceive these products?
No, it's not only that, because what you mean as an alternative is more like the plant-based, because what usually is done in the plant-based industry is taking protein from a plant source, like soy proteins, the pea proteins, and they put a lot of pressure on these proteins in order to make them behave like the milk proteins, and by that, to create different types of plant-based dairy products. In our case, we have the same proteins. It's identical to the proteins in cow's milk. So basically, it's behaves the same. When we create cream cheese, for example, it has the same flavor, the same nutritional value, the same experience of a traditional dairy product, but without the downsides, like no hormones, no antibiotics, no lactose, and no cholesterol.
Yet this is an animal-free protein.
Exactly.
What are the applications? Is this produced as a raw substance, which is then applied to, as you mentioned, cream cheese, any other kind of milk, pudding, any other, you know, that a food manufacturer will then take this product, this protein, to make whatever food item they want?
Yeah, basically what we are doing, our product is a protein powder. It's coming in powder form, so you can ship it all over the world. And locally, you can convert it to different dairy products. So the dairy companies like, for example, Strauss or Danone Groups can take this powder and then they convert it into cream cheese, milk, ice cream, and many other applications. You know, basically, they can do all range of the dairy products that are produced today with the milk proteins.
You mentioned some of the benefits of this kind of a protein, hormone-free and so forth, perhaps nutritionally. What are other positive impacts of producing the protein through this, like taking a larger look, say, at the environment and the general industry?
The agriculture in general is responsible for a high percentage of the carbon emission in the world. It's like somewhere around 15%. While the dairy industry is responsible for around 3.5% of the carbon emission in the world, which is more than double of the carbon emission coming from the aviation industry. So with our technology, we basically reduce the carbon emission by 97% we use 98% less water, 99% less land. So the environmental impact using precision fermentation is huge on the environment.
Now, your company itself has had a milestone of sorts with an FDA accreditation or letter. Can you explain what this means?
It means that now we are allowed to sell our product in the U.S. market. This is the first milestone from regulatory-wise. So we can sell our product today on the shelves in the supermarkets in the U.S.
Would you say that this is the general direction that food production is taking, finding these animal-free products, that this will eventually become the major segment in this sector?
That is, yes. No, the current dairy industry is not sustainable. So, and there are already huge gaps in our ability to produce enough proteins compared to what are the demands. So we need to find better ways to produce dairy. And our technology basically offers the consumer the same experience. They don't need to compromise on taste, flavor, and nutrition while get all the benefits, the environmental benefits and the nutritional benefits with our technology. So it will take time, but it will become bigger and bigger while our supply chain will get bigger and bigger. So this is today is the main bottleneck of the industry, is to have more ability to produce in higher scale and for more and more proteins.
So at this point, is the product being used to create food that is now already commercially available?
So there are already products that are commercialized in the U.S., not our products, but our products will be commercialized in the U.S. very soon.
Where did the idea for creating this product come from? Was anyone lactose intolerant, a vegan, or thinking about fermentation and the direction of development?
For me, it was the motivation that I tried, you know, to change my diet so many times and failed. You know, because there were no good products out there, and it required me to compromise the way I like to eat dairy or even meat. So this was my main motivation for establishing the company, so to offer a much better solution and to make, you know, I already know that to change diet is one of the challenging tasks for humans to do.
Dr. Eyal Afragan, co-founder and CEO of Imagine Dairy. That's our show for this evening. I'm Aryeh O'Sullivan wishing you a Shabbat Shalom, and we leave you with this song by Rami Kleinstein, Bayom Shel Haftatza, the day of the bombing.
Ishave ish kachagim.